Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Jason Stark, a longtime columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, is a senior writer for ESPN.com. In addition to his writing, he appears on radio and television shows, including SportsCenter, ESPN News, and Baseball Tonight. He also has a weekly segment during baseball season with WHBA 10 in Kansas City. His first book, The Stark Truth, The Most Overrated and Underrated Players in Baseball History, was published in 2007. He followed that up with Worth the Wait, Tales of the 2008 Phillies, which tells a story of the 2008 World Championship team from the perspective of a Philadelphian. Stark was a member of a panel at the 2013 Sabre Convention in Philadelphia about baseball and the media. It was moderated by Alan Schwartz of the New York Times and featured Leonte Landino of ESPN Deportes, 2013 Spink Award recipient Paul Hagen of MLB.com, and Donald Hunt of the Philadelphia Tribune. And in my opinion, that was the highlight of the whole event. And if you visit the Baseball Bookshelf blog, you'll find a link to the YouTube video. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Jason Stark. Jason Stark, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Ron, thank you for inviting me to the Baseball Bookshelf.
So these essays are taken from your work on ESPN.com. How many pieces do you figure you've written for them over the years?
$5 billion, give or take a half a billion. I don't know. One year when I was in spring training, they actually had a pool in my office on how many words I was going to write. And I think the over-under was 100,000, just so you know I didn't make it. But I gave it a run.
I'm curious. When it comes to blogging, what is the expectation? Are you supposed to put out a certain amount of words or a certain amount of pieces per day, per week, per month? How does that work?
No, we try to figure it out as we go along because, you know, one thing about working at ESPN is you don't just write. It's a lot of other stuff you do. So it really varies day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year. There's really no hard and fast rule about what I'm going to write or when I'm going to write it.
Now, your current title is that of senior baseball writer. So what are those special responsibilities as a senior writer as opposed to a regular?
I don't know. I've been trying to figure this out. I'm a senior writer, but I never graduate. So I've been a senior writer since the day I got there, and I just assume that's just a standard title for somebody like me. But I do know that it's an awesome place to work. The coolest thing I think about working there is you get to work with people who wake up every day and think, what great thing can we do today? You know, everybody's so smart and so talented and so creative. It's a tremendous environment.
Because it's always changing. Every day is a new opportunity, a new challenge.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, plus, you have an audience, too, that is totally into everything, you know, and that's a great feeling, too, as a writer. Is there's almost nothing that you could write working at a place like ESPN and ESPN.com where people wouldn't care about it and weigh in about it and love it and hate it and everything in between.
Now, a minute ago you said the title was given to somebody like you. Are you referring to your length of service in the industry?
No, I just think it's, people who are, quote-unquote lead columnists or regular columnists at ESPN.com, I believe, we're all senior writers. If we're not, I need to look into this.
Now, prior to coming to ESPN, you were at the Philadelphia Inquirer. How do the styles differ between writing for a newspaper and blogging?
Well, I mean, I don't just blog at ESPN, too. So, that, you know, I can write really, really long pieces. I can write columns, and I can blog and, you know, all kinds of other stuff, too. But, I mean, obviously, the newspaper business has evolved quite a bit. I haven't been out of it that long. 2000 was when I left the Inquirer. But back then, I would say that newspapers were still living very much in a tomorrow morning kind of world. And from the moment I set foot in ESPN, I became very aware of how different it was to live in a 24/7 kind of world where, you know, in the newspaper business, back then at least, if you had a story, you know, nobody was breaking stories on their website then. You were trying to, you know, make sure nobody else found out about it till it ran in the paper the next day. And obviously, I mean, that's almost laughable. That feels like prehistoric media times now. We're talking about this millennium. It's incredible. Right. And, you know, it's, to me, it's a lot more fun and a lot more invigorating and a lot more real to live in this world. It seems so bizarre in retrospect to think about the way, you know, you'd have to kind of, you know, especially if you know, back in the days when I was on the beat, if I had something that I knew the other reporters on that beat didn't have, trying to act nonchalant and, you know, like just another day at the office while I wrote up my blockbuster Pulitzer Prize winning scoop. But, you know, now, especially thanks to Twitter and social media, it's almost like we're doing play-by-play of everything in the world in real time. It's pretty crazy.
Now, you mentioned the 24/7 business. At last year's Sabre convention in Philly, you spoke about the social media aspects. On the previous Baseball Bookshelf podcast, I had Hal Bodley as a guest who's been doing this even longer than you. And he wrote about the changes he's noticed in the press box where reporters are tweeting and interacting with social media to such an extent that it almost seems that they're not paying attention to the game that's going on the field.
Well, social media can be really distracting if you let it be, but I actually think that social media has been great for our business, has been great for those of us who write, and it really does give us a chance to interact with our audience and with the people we write about, for that matter. I mean, I've actually forged relationships with players through social media before I really even got to know them. You know, they'll tweet back at me over stuff I've written or tweeted or linked to, and it's fun. I'm not saying that everything about social media is good and admirable. I mean, I worry, like a lot of people in my business do, that the rush to tweet something before everybody else, 30 seconds before everybody else, makes people rush into mistakes, and that's never good. And, you know, one thing that I think is great about ESPN is we've talked a lot about this, and, I mean, they want us to apply the same standards to what we tweet, to what we report on the air, say on the air, write on the site. And so, you know, rather than have that frenzy to be first and wrong and have to tweet 2 minutes later, retract previous tweet. There's a lot of emphasis at our place on being right, and you know the fact that some people are more concerned with being first or being fast than being right. That to me is a lot bigger worry about Twitter than you know people who might miss a pitch.
So it sounds like, as a person who has been at this for quite a while and a person of your stature and veteranship, you're embracing all this new stuff rather than, you know, saying, oh, things are better in the old days when we used to take the time and, you know, I had the press thing in my fedora, the headband in my fedora.
I never had one of those, just so you know. Yeah, I do. I think it's great. People don't get their news about sports in any one particular way anymore. You know, there might have been a time when almost everybody got their news from the newspaper that was dropped on their doorstep. I mean, those days are long gone. And so I think that everything that you do, every way that you tell the story challenges a different part of your brain. At ESPN, we try to tell the stories every possible way they can be told. We write about it. We tweet about it. We talk about it on TV. We talk about it on radio. We talk about it on podcasts. We do blogs and video blogs and spreecasts. And, I mean, I could keep going, but we now do stuff as a regular part of telling stories that didn't even exist a year ago. You know, I never heard of a Spreecast a year ago, and now we do these live, interactive video chats. It's amazing. What an amazing world. And that's the world we live in. And so part of being a reporter and a writer in this world means adapting to that. But, I mean, to me, it's just as much fun as someone who delivers information as it is to be someone who consumes the information all those different ways.
So you have no conflict or no trouble with before you were writing and enjoying that, and now you're called upon to do the radio and to do the TV and to do all these other things. You don't think, gee, I'd rather just be left alone to write?
That's the world. You know, are there times where I've wondered, is it possible to clone myself? Those times happen. You know, there are times when a really big story is exploding, and at ESPN, you know, you're trying to do 17 things at once, and it can be hard to find the time to write when you're in the studio, and then you have to do radio, and then you know you're zigging here and zagging there. But that is part of the fun of it, and everybody at ESPN kind of understands that's the deal. And we all, you know, we use every different medium to play off every other different medium. And, I mean, that's one of the things that ESPN has always done best and, you know, in some respects, in many respects, actually even did first, forged the way for the rest of the media world. I'm not saying that to brag because I work there. It's just, it's an awesome thing to behold when you see it in action.
Now, let's actually talk about the book.
Sure.
Now, I know on the dust jacket, it says ESPN's Jason Stark. Is that a contractual obligation on their part or just a marketing decision?
I wanted to make sure that it said ESPN's Jason Stark because most of this material did appear first on ESPN.com. So, that was something that I requested.
Okay. Now, as to the content of the book, it's divided into chapters based on various themes. But for someone who's written as much as you have, how do you go about choosing the actual essays that appear in the book?
It was really fun, and it was really hard.
Yeah.
You know, once I kind of informally agreed with the people at Triumph Books a little over a year ago that I was going to do this book, I really spent all of last season, like when I had a free moment, you know, going through years and years and years worth of columns and blogs and all sorts of stuff that I've written and, you know, came up with a working list. And when I actually went back and looked at everything, I probably had 300,000 words, so that wasn't going to work. And so then I just kept whittling away and trying to think about, all right, what works best in book form? You know, what holds up best if you're reading it in a book? Not, you know, because a lot of this stuff was originally written in the moment. And, you know, when days and weeks and years pass, it doesn't read the same or look the same. So a lot of these pieces were actually tweaked and updated and, you know, in some cases changed substantially in order to help them adapt to the fact they were appearing in a book. But, I mean, mostly, you know, what I wanted to do was try to find a way to look back over, you know, my 14 years at ESPN and get to weigh in on all my favorite things about baseball. And I love it when people tell me this book made them laugh, it made them think, it made them argue with their friends about all sorts of stuff. That was one of the points of doing this. I got to look at my favorite people and my favorite memories and my favorite October moments and my favorite October champions. I got to weigh in on what I thought was the greatest World Series game of all time. I got to look back on, you know, all right, how did Cal Ripken and the last game at Tiger Stadium convince us that baseball history is different than the history of other sports? I got to compile my favorite strange but true feats of the millennium. How did Benji Molina manage to not score a run on his own home run? I love to write about all sorts of stuff like that, and I wanted to make sure that all of it was represented among the fun stuff you could find in this book.
Now, were these totally your decisions, or did you work with someone who said, you know, too much of this, a little more of that?
I obviously had an editor at Triumph, and, you know, mostly this was my call. There were a couple of times where when we gathered everything together and tried to organize it in one place, my editors at Triumph said, you know, this chapter could use X or this chapter could use Y. And so I tried to find a piece that fit that. There were times when, you know, looking at it again, I felt like this piece didn't belong, or it belonged somewhere else, or we needed to reorder. So it was a very interactive process and a really fun process.
I'm sure you have enough material left over for Wild Pitch Part 2.
Yeah, you know, the strange but true Feats of the Millennium chapter, every year I write exactly. You know, every year I write a piece that we run at the end of the calendar year, and sometimes it's a two-part series. It's even been a four-part series one year. The strange but true feats of the year, all the impossible stuff that happened in baseball. But, you know, it really did happen, even though it seems like it could never have happened. And a long time ago, my mother told me that I should write a book and call it I Never Saw That Before. Well, this would be that book. And we excerpted that chapter on ESPN.com, and a lot of people have said to me, that is a book. And who knows? Maybe it will be. I got a lot of stuff.
Well, that's what they always say about baseball. You know, you should come to the, you always have the opportunity to see something you've never seen before.
Yeah, exactly right. And that, you know, that strange but true piece is living proof. I mean, the fact that a guy really did hit a home run but not score a run on his own homer, the fact that a guy got on second base and then stole first base, the fact that a 33-year-old rookie made his major league debut by appearing in a game he never appeared in, I mean, all that stuff actually happened. It's tremendous.
And we've been talking with Jason Stark, the author of Wild Pitches, Rumblings, Grumblings, and Reflections on the Game I Love, published by Triumph. I just wanted to mention that Jason was at last year's Sabre Convention talking about baseball and media. I'll put up a link to that video on the website. Jason, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Ron, it was awesome. Thank you very much for having me.
And that was our very entertaining conversation with Jason Stark. Once again, apologies for all the animal sounds in the background. If you're a regular listener, you know that we have a whole menagerie here, and it's impossible to keep anybody quiet for more than a few seconds. Anyway, remember to visit the bookshelf often. We have that weekly baseball contest. Send in a comment. You might get a free book. And tune in again soon for our next Baseball Bookshelf Podcast segment. Thanks, everybody. Bye. If old man Columbus had sat in the stands, had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.